Hey, we are with you right up till Oakland A's baseball. Hope you are on your way to a fabulous weekend. Hey, we finally have some football to talk about this weekend with the Hall of Fame game. You know, you look at, you know, at least you know it's close. When you see two teams on the field, hey, at least you know it's coming up right around the corner. So that's a positive. The Gold Jackets tomorrow, the enshrinement into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And as we all have been talking about, most of the attention has been going towards Brett Favre, and I get that. But, boy, look at all the other tremendous Hall of Famers to be. This is a good class. And it's Brett Favre this, Brett Favre that, Brett Favre this, Brett Favre that. I guess that's the way it is. That's the type of that's the way we are with the media-driven country. Everyone's talking about Favre. We're going to be talking football in the NFC South. Obviously, when you look at that division, Carolina's clearly the team to beat. But we're going to talk right now with Anthony Becht. He's a former tight end in the NFL. He actually had a nice 11-year career, was drafted by the Jets, played there for 4 years, spent a couple of years in Tampa, also played with St. Louis, Arizona, and Kansas City before he was done in 2011. He's part of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers broadcast team, and he joins us right now here on Sports 1140 KHDK. Anthony, thank you for coming on. My name is Grant Napier. How are you?
Got it, man. Grant doing well. Thanks for having me.
You know, it was interesting. I was watching the NFL Network, and they were interviewing Winston, and he said something that really struck me. He was asked about, you know, leadership and, you know, his working out, and he said, you know what, it's really important to me that I'm here and that the guys are watching me sweat, and I try to beat a lot of the guys to get my workout in, so when they get here, they're like, man, you've already done your workout. And you know what, talk about his maturation process so early in his career now and what you see.
Yeah, you know, he's been doing that since day one. I mean, he's really set the precedence, you know, for a rookie coming into the league at arguably the toughest position to earn the respect of his teammates by just doing those kind of things. And I think the biggest thing that you see with him is it's real, it's natural, he wants to do it, he's all dialed in on football. It's first in his life, and it's second in his life, and there's nothing else going on. And guys appreciate that, guys embrace that, and guys follow that. And it's been showing not only on the field, but off the field, too.
Anthony, you played in this league a long time, and it doesn't take long to spot the phonies, right? And so what you're saying, this is a real sincere deal. This is the way he is. This is a guy that's really, you know, showing leadership, and he's doing it, and people are buying into it.
He is. I mean, you know, not only that, but, you know, the way he gravitates his teammates on the practice field. You know, there were times in the offseason where, you know, even during the season where, you know, he called out several players and said, listen, you know, whether it be Mike Evans at the receiver position, telling him, you know, we're going to do some extra stuff. You need to stay out here. I ain't going to throw you the ball. It pretty much came down to that. So, I mean, it's just not only was he, you know, gathering the truth, but even the young guys, I mean, just setting the precedent. So I think when you look at that and you talk about an organization that's trying to, you know, really turn things around, it starts with the quarterback. When that kind of guy comes through your building, and you can lean on that. That really does kind of trickle effect everybody else.
All right, let's talk a little bit about this Tampa team in a division where the, you know, clearly Carolina has the best talent, and I'm not so sure what to expect from Atlanta and New Orleans, but let's start talking about Tampa. Give me some areas of concern that you see with this young team that's coming around.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, I've been at practice the last 2 days just watching them, and I kind of wanted to get them a few days under their belt to kind of see what they got going on. And I'll tell you, I'm impressed. I'm really impressed with the depth that they have. They are a young, aspiring team, but they really do have depth at the offensive and defensive line now. I think they made some nice moves in free agency to really address some of the needs on defense at the cornerback position, the defensive end position. And with their draft picks, they've been very successful. Jason Light doing a nice job bringing guys in, not only that can contribute, but can actually, you know, start with his last two draft classes. You know, if you had to pick an area that you thought this team you would have to worry about, would be the safety position. I mean, that has not changed. It's the same two guys, Chris Conte, Bradley McDougal, and then with Keith Candy and Major Wright back there also. And there are a few young guys that are vying for that position. But I think with the new system, you know, Mike Smith, you see a lot more pressure, a lot of things going on a daily basis in practice where you didn't really see – in the last two seasons with Lovie Smith's defense, as far as going against Jameis Winston and trying to make things tough for him on a day-to-day basis. So I think they're growing. I think they got more confidence. They are young, but they're not in the sense that, you know, they got a bunch of rookies in there. They've all played together starting last season, the year before. So a lot of speed, a lot of youth, a lot of buzz and excitement with this team right now.
Well, that's good. Anthony Beck joining us, talking about the Bucks and that division. Carolina, obviously the team to beat. When you look at them, they lose a very, very good cornerback in Josh Norman to Washington. But do you still see this team being a 12-13 win team?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I mean, listen, they gain their top receiver comes back in Calvin Benjamin. You're right. Collectively, when you look at this football team, they are the best team in the division. They're the team that has to be beat and taken down. Will they slip a couple games, not win as many? You know, it's hard to tell. It's always tough to duplicate what you've done the year before. I think they have a good enough defense with the other guys to kind of raise up the losses of some of their players that aren't there, like you said, with Josh Norman. But, you know, he's a tremendous player. He's a shutdown corner. He's a guy that you can kind of take away that half of the field. And he brought a type of a swagger to that side of the defense and in the secondary. So it will be a loss. And I think, you know, the teams that play them early and have them on their schedule early need to take advantage of that before, you know, they start clicking towards the middle end of the season.
Beck joining us here on the Grant Napier Show. I know when you were in Tampa, John Gruden was the coach, but if I'm not mistaken, when you came into the NFL, Herm Edwards was in New York, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. Al Groh, well, Bill Parcells was the general manager. Al Groh was there my first season, and then Herm Edwards and Terry Bradway were there.
Okay, because the reason why I'm asking is, you know, if you go from Herm Edwards to Gruden, I energy and passion, it probably doesn't take much to get motivated to get out on the field.
Well, you know, playing with a guy with John Gruden, I mean, he was arguably my favorite coach that I played for. He had a deep passion for the game, offensive-minded guy. And, you know, I was never more prepared on Sunday from what we did from Monday to Saturday than any other coach I'd ever been around. And that's a good feeling, because when you go on the field and you see what defense is doing, the intricacies that they bring to the table week in and week out, I felt like I was never fooled, and I was always prepared, and I could go play fast. And that was what was important. If you could handle the workload, if you could handle what he was putting on the table and really got dialed in on it, you could be successful. And we had a nice run here when he was the coach.
I mean, because of – and I was covering the Raiders when he was the coach, and I used to watch the way, you know, he conducted practices, and then you used to hear stories about his preparation and how much he knew. I mean, you were talking about if you could get, you know, what – and I'm trying to put it in the words you did, but were there some guys that it was – I don't want to say too advanced, but they didn't get it?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, the quarterbacks had a lot on their plate. You know, John's the kind of guy that if he saw one blitz that you ran over the last 2 years, he was going to have some kind of audible for it going into the game plan.
That's amazing.
And, you know, guys like Greasy and Sims and Garcia, you know, these guys are like, really? Like, you know, all this stuff you want to put on our plate? I mean,
that's funny.
On what they're doing. So, I'd always say the quarterbacks are always kind of like, had their head spinning when they were working with him, because he was really hands-on with everything. I mean, he was the head coach, but he called the plays. He installed the offense during the week. He drew the cards. I mean, you know, he did everybody's job, even though they were doing their jobs too. So he was very detailed, and those are the things that, you know, that made him great, but also made him tough as a coach.
It's good stuff right there. One last thing on the Tampa Bay Bucks, you know, when you're starting, I don't want to make it seem like they're starting all over, but obviously they made the investment. They took a young quarterback, and you have to wait. And I thought he played much better last year than I thought he would. I was very surprised. I'm a big believer that your success of your football team, it has to start with the quarterback. You know, you've been in the league. You know what the process is. What is the realistic expectations for the fans down in Tampa? I mean, you said you've been in practice. You're going to be covering this team all year. So what do we look at as a realistic expectation for this team?
Well, number one, I mean, listen, he's much more advanced than a lot of quarterbacks coming in the league. Number two, when you see a top drafted quarterback, they usually come onto bad teams that have bad lines. I'll be honest with you. I really like our offensive line. I think we have a top 10, maybe a top 7, pushing into that 5 range of offensive linemen with some depth. And you've got a tremendous backfield with two guys that can run and catch the football. So those are key elements to really advance your quarterback, and then throw everything else that he's, you know, made up of, his tangibles and intangibles and how smart he is with the football, and coming back to the same offense from last year. So, you know, listen, what's realistic records? I mean, I'll say this. This is going to be one of the scarier teams to play week in and week out. You're not going to want to play the Tampa Bay Bucks and feel comfortable that, you know, we can chalk this one up. I think 8-8's realistic. Can they push to get 10 wins and be a team that creeps in the back door of the playoffs? I truly believe that. I think they can do that. But, you know, I think they're definitely going to take a step forward this year. I think the defense is going to be a much better defense. They're going to have some better players out there that are playing with some more experience. And I think that culmination of having Dirk Koetter back another year with
absolutely.
The offense back, it'll be big.
I was just going to ask you about Dirk Koetter. I just think it's so difficult. You know, you go from, I think, what was Morris, then Greg Schiano had a cup of coffee there, then Lovey's only there for a little while. I mean, you know, that to me, you got to have stability at that position. So you like Dirk Koetter, huh?
I do. You know, Dirk kind of gets it. He's been around some successful organizations. He's been a successful offensive coordinator with the Jags, the Falcons, and now Tampa Bay. He's been there, done that. He's prepared and ready to take this on. And he made a key hire with Mike Smith, being that he's a former head coach and a much better, I think, defensive coordinator, where he made his name in the NFL. So you put those two together. And, you know, the best thing about Dirk is he's kind of a no-nonsense, tell you how it is. There's no BS. There's no in-between the lines. You know you're either the guy or you're not, or where you stand. And I think players respect that. And moving forward, that's going to help him kind of get the most out of the players.
Anthony Beck, former tight end in the NFL. One last thing I was going to ask you about, you know, your position. And a guy that I just respect the heck out of, and yet I hate the team, is Jason Witten with Dallas. And the guy lines up every week to play. He's a consummate professional, great team guy. And I'm hoping we're not seeing the last of that mode, you know, the Jason Wittens of the world. Give me your thoughts on him.
Well, number one, he's arguably one of the best tight ends that ever played the game. A superior technical route runner that with not a lot of speed. I don't think he had great speed, but he knew how to get open. He knew how to play to find the holes in the defense, and he still does it at a very high level. And I think he's actually gotten better as a blocker, which, you know, has kind of carried him through and kept him on the field probably longer than a lot of tight ends. And, you know, how many years he's got left, I'm not sure, but he's definitely a dying breed. You know, you see those kind of well-rounded, every down tight ends that can stay on it no matter what the situation. They're hard to find. You know, Gronkowski's still out there, but you can count on your hand how many of those tight ends there are, and Jason Witten's one of them. So hopefully we see a few. You know, we like to have one. We thought we had one here, the second-round pick, Austin Seferian Jenkins. We're still kind of waiting for him to kind of figure it all out, but we definitely have a nice crew of tight ends in Tampa. So we'll see what happens, but, you know, it's definitely a dying breed, and I'm waiting for those guys to come in. I do college football every week. And I get excited when I see some of these tight ends. And I think Jim Harbaugh's got an opportunity to throw some of these guys into the league. He's got a kid named Jake Butts that's pretty good. So maybe he's the next kind of dual threat kind of tight end that comes into the NFL.
Why do you say it's a dying breed?
It's a dying breed because when you look at what's coming from college, it's pass happy. It's more spread. It's more inside receiver. So you're either an undersized, bigger kind of wide receiver that doesn't have the huge strength and speed, or if you're, you know, you're a blocking tight end, they're going to use you and maybe develop you into a tight end a tackle position. So it's hard to get that mix. There's very few teams that are running pro-style offenses in college. You know, you look at Michigan, you look at the Alabamas, the Arkansas, the LSUs. Those are really it. So it's really slim picking. So when you're talking about guys coming in at the next level, they are not ready to take on the blocking duties at the tight end position. Perfect example is Jason Morrow. From Texas Tech, came in. He caught a ton of balls in college, but it just is not translating to him. He can't stay on the field because he just doesn't get the entirety of the position. So it takes a while. It took me a while, even though I was a well-rounded tight end, came into the league as a first-rounder. It took me 2-3 years to figure out how to block defensive ends and do those kind of things in the league. And, you know, I took off from there. But, you know, these guys coming in right now, they got no shot. They're behind the eight ball. They really have to be coached up.
So basically, the biggest question mark with guys coming in is the blocking aspect of what you have to do in the NFL as a tight end. You think that's the toughest thing for these guys to grasp when they get into the NFL?
It is. And when you see, you know, a lot of these teams are throwing and splitting their tight ends out, that's great. But when you look at when they need the run yards and the rushing, they're pulling an extra offensive tackle in. And that really does help the defense dictate what they're doing in the pass and run game with those kind of formations. So
interesting.
If you can keep two tight ends on the football field or even one, that definitely spreads things out and gives more balance against a defense.
Hey, Anthony, great stuff. I really enjoyed this. Thank you very much for your time.
You got it, Grant. Take care anytime.
All right, thank you. That's Anthony Beck talking about the NFL in general. That's really interesting, you know, about the tight end position because of the way they play, you know, college football and the difficulties of a lot of these guys – in terms of blocking. Very interesting. If you want to call the show, 339-1140. That's 339-1140 and 800-920-1140. I'm really looking forward at 6 o'clock to have Damon Hack on from the Golf Channel. Does a great job. I'm going to ask him about golf down in Rio as that starts. I believe it starts tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken. I think the golfing portion of the Olympics starts tomorrow, if not today, because I was talking in Lake Tahoe with Steve Sands, part of the golf coverage, and I'm really going to be curious to see what the numbers are in terms of the ratings when we get to golf, especially in the medal round. It'll be very interesting to see. All right, as if you want to text the show, you can do so at 44-1140. That's 44-1140. A couple of things that are going on this weekend, and I wanted to ask you, Brett Favre is being inducted into the Hall of Fame, and I'm curious where he would be on your list. He's not a top five quarterback on my list, but he I had this conversation this morning, and interestingly enough, most of the calls on this topic were from Green Bay, and so I get that. I think Aaron Rodgers is a better quarterback than Brett Favre, and in my opinion, at age 32, when Aaron Rodgers retires from the NFL, and again, this is barring a significant injury, I think in Green Bay and in the National Football League, a lot of people will consider Aaron Rodgers to be the greatest quarterback in the history of the Packers. Now, that doesn't mean that Brett Favre isn't worthy of a Hall of Famer. That's not what I mean. Brett Favre is worthy of being in the Hall of Fame, should be in the Hall of Fame, and I have no issues with Brett Favre being in the Hall of Fame. But I can't put a guy in the top five that had as many interceptions as Brett Favre, and you'll come back and say, yeah, well, he played a lot of years. Yes, he did. But I can't pick a guy. I can't put a guy in the top five that his last pass ever as a member of the Green Bay Packers was an interception by Corey Webster in overtime that set up the game-winning field goal for the Giants, and then they went on and won the Super Bowl against New England. I can't I can't put a guy in the top five of all time when all he needs to do is, be conservative. They're in field goal range, kick a field goal, and you're on your way to the Super Bowl as the quarterback with the Minnesota Vikings. And, rolling out to the left, throwing across his body, and one maybe the worst pass he's ever made, getting picked off, which cost the Vikings a chance at the Super Bowl. I can't do that. I can't put him in the top five. I just can't, and I recognize how great he was when he was great. I get that. And there's a lot of things I love about Brett Favre. But if I'm going to put someone like that in the top five, I mean, we never had a conversation about that like with a Joe Montana, all right? We don't have conversations like that with, John Elway and some others. And so give me your thoughts on that. Let's get to Brian. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Grant.
Hello.
Hey, one thing about Brett Favre is you got to remember that he played 267 consecutive games. And so
I'm totally aware of that.
A lot of passes.
I'm totally aware of that, and his competitive spirit and everything was maybe as good as we've ever seen in the National Football League.
I agree, absolutely. And then all those games played in a row, the percentage to throw interceptions is probably higher, right?
No, I'm not as concerned necessarily with the number of interceptions because I think when you play that long, I mean, obviously. You're going to have a lot of touchdown passes and you're going to have a lot of interceptions. But
yeah,
and you got to be honest here, all right? I mean, the way he ended his career in Green Bay.
Buddy, I was at that game in 07 against your Giants.
Yep, 20 below zero with the wind chill.
I was in the north corner end zone and watched him throw that interception.
Right? That was a bad, bad throw. I mean,
oh, man.
Bad throw. And of course, how cold it was that day. Was that the coldest game?
Yeah.
Coldest game you've ever been at?
Ever.
Yeah.
In my life.
The wind chill was 20 below.
I've been in California for over 20 years now, but I always fly back for the game.
That's my bucket list. I think I'm going to do that this year. I'm working on it. I got to see if I can make it happen. I've never been to Lambeau Field.
Oh, you got to check it out, man.
Yeah. Well, will I be okay if I wear my Giants gear, or will I get
totally?
All right.
We're partying with the Giants fans after the
That's
game.
That's great.
It's a good situation. It's a small community. They're happy people.
Yep.
Usually.
Yeah, no, I've heard that, and obviously it's such a special, iconic place.
I go like in late fall. Don't go in January.
No, this game is, I think, the first Sunday in October, which would be perfect.
Perfect. Yep. That's perfect. You can get a little taste of the cold weather.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Cool, man.
Hey, Brian, have a great weekend. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the time, man.
My pleasure. Take care.
All right,
if you want to call the program, 339-1140. That's 339-1140 and 800-920-1140. Somebody said, Grant, they throw the ball more now in the league than when Favre played. There's no question. The games, that's why it's so difficult to compare eras, because the rules are different in all the eras. I mean, are you kidding me? Can you imagine Fred Biletnikoff in his era, where you wouldn't be able to touch him after 5 yards from the line of scrimmage? Really? Remember, you used to be able to mug receivers running down the field. So, yeah, the rules and everything has changed when it comes to offense in the National Football League. All right, we'll take the time out. You're listening to the Grant Napier Show on your home for the best live and local coverage of the National Football League, Sports 1140 KHTK. Grant Napier, I hope you're on your way to a fabulous weekend. I'm with you right up until Oakland A's baseball. 339-1140, 800-920-1140. And we check in with Frank. Hello, Frank.
Hi, Grant. How are you doing today?
I'm well, Frank. What's up?
I just want to get in the conversation. I know you're talking about Brett Favre. But quarterback that came up to my mind was Dan Marino. What do you think? Would you rank Dan Marino higher than Brett Favre on your list?
I would, yes.
You would, yeah.
I know.
Dan Marino went to one Super Bowl, but he had the numbers as well. So
yeah, unfortunately, Dan Marino, you know, never had a good defense, or rarely had good defenses. But Dan Marino to me is one of the best quarterbacks to ever play.
What would you rank him in your top 10 or?
He'd be in my top 10, but he's not my top 5. I haven't even done my complete list, but I would probably have him around 8, maybe 9. I'd put Johnny Unitas ahead of him. Johnny Unitas I'd put ahead of Brett Favre. And now the problem with me saying that, you know, a good portion of my audience never saw Johnny Unitas play. And Johnny Unitas was great. He was great. He was phenomenal. And I can't ignore that.
Perfect, yeah. I just wanted to know, get your input on that. Thanks, Grant.
All right, thank you, Frank. I appreciate it. All right, 339-1140 and 800-920-1140. I mean, if you can agree in whatever order, you don't have to go 1, 2, or 3, but if you put Montana, Brady, Elway, to me, Peyton Manning, I would put ahead of Brett Favre. Clearly, I'd put him ahead of Brett Favre. I would put Marino ahead of Favre. That's just me. So those are 5 right there. I would put Johnny Unitas ahead of Favre. That's my opinion. That's 6. And there's 2 ways of judging quarterbacks, and I know that in the Hall of Fame you can't do that, but I like to – here's my tiebreaker. I always like to look at it this way. If you had one game to win, would you want Brett Favre as your quarterback? Think about that for a minute. You have one game to win. Out of all of those that I just mentioned, who are you taking to win the game for you? I'd take Joe Montana personally. I mean, you look at his big games. Now, he didn't play great in all the games that he played in, but he played great in most of the games, okay? Joe Montana was, let me put it to you this way about Joe Montana. Joe Montana was not going to cost you the game because of a mistake that he made. I guess that's the best way I can put it. I can't say that about Brett Favre. You know, you talk about Montana in big games. You know, I was at the game where they lost 49-3. Well, that wasn't Joe Montana's fault. You know, Joe Montana wasn't the reason why the Niners lost that game. And the championship game that he lost against the Giants, he got hit from behind by Leonard Marshall and was done for the game. So I can't put that on him. They probably win the game if he doesn't get hurt. I'm trying to think of other playoff games. Joe Montana was just always, you didn't lose a game because of Joe. I guess that's the best way I can say it. When the 49ers were in the playoffs, you didn't turn off the TV or walk out of the stadium and go, damn, boy, Montana was terrible. You know, like, that's why I don't think Donovan McNabb's a Hall of Fame quarterback and should never be in the Hall of Fame, because you used to say that all the time when you left playoff games. Gee, McNabb was terrible. Yeah, you never said that about Joe Montana. And so, you know, to me, I would put Montana, I would put Brady, I would put Elway, I would put Peyton, I would put Marino, I would put Unitas, clearly ahead of Brett Favre. But it's subjective. There are some that would have Favre higher, but I can't. I can't. Somebody said, don't forget about Dan Fouts. Yeah, his name hasn't even come up in this conversation, but you're right. I mean, Dan Fouts, can you imagine what would have happened if San Diego had a good defense when he was playing? Whoa. Oh, who's coming on? Dan? Great. Dan Fouts is coming on next week. I'm happy to hear that. I'm looking forward to talking to Dan Fouts. Of course, he and Ian Eagle with a phenomenal team on CBS. Somebody says, what specific credentials or bullet points make a player eligible for the Hall? Well, first of all, years of service. How many years did they play? You know, are their numbers comparable to other players that are currently in the Hall that played their position? You know, those are some of the things. I've talked to Peter King about this and how they vote for Hall of Famers, but those are some of the things that they look at. Chris in Carmichael, you're on with Grant Napier. Hello, Chris.
Hey, how you doing? You know, I'm a Packer fan, and I'll tell you right now, Brett Favre was the third best quarterback the Packers ever had. And Bart Starr was better, and Aaron Rodgers is better. But if I had to pick one guy to watch, I'd always watch Favre. He had more heart than any other guy I've ever seen.
Yeah, no, he was must-see TV. I totally agree with you on that.
And I think you're overlooking Bart Starr as a better quarterback than almost any other guy on that list. Maybe Unitas was better, and Marino on a game day at certain times was better. But Bart Starr managed games better than anybody else in the NFL. They were kind of boring to watch in those days, but they were fantastic in terms of their record. And, you know, he won, what, 6 championships?
Bart Starr was great. You're right. I probably should give him more credit than I do. You make a great point. I did watch Bart Starr play in the 60s often, both in person and on TV. And, you know, you're right. I loved the Bart Starr to Carroll Dale combination. That was so much fun. And, you know, they had the great Hall of Famers, obviously, all over the field. But, you know what? Bart Starr was great. You're exactly right.
And then I think you got to acknowledge the fact that Aaron Rodgers might be the smartest quarterback right now in the NFL.
He might be. I don't know. You know, without Peyton Manning, yes, I'd have to include Tom Brady in that conversation. Yeah. But, yes, he may be. I haven't even thought about that from his perspective. I'd be very surprised if he does not have a heck of a year this season. He did not have a typical Aaron Rodgers year, and I think part of that was not having Jordy Nelson, but I don't just think he was right last year. I think Aaron Rodgers is going to have an outstanding year this season. I really do.
That's right. I just want to make those points.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, let's get to John. Hello, John.
Hey, happy Friday, Grant.
Same to you, John.
Thank you. I just wanted to get your thoughts. I know this gentleman doesn't have the years of service, but his stats and when he was in the role was just about as good as Favre. What do you think about Warner over Favre?
No, I wouldn't put Kurt Warner ahead of Brett Favre. I really wouldn't. I mean, that's subjective, but there's, you know, he had the great year with the greatest show on turf. And I know that he took Arizona, a second team to the Super Bowl. He had a lot of bad years in between that, but he also had a lot of good years. To me, I can't put Kurt Warner ahead of Brett Favre.
All right. Makes sense.
All right. Thank you. 339-1140, 800-920-1140. But a very good quarterback, but I can't put him ahead of Favre. I'd have to put Favre ahead of him. But, you know, I shouldn't say us. I was alive and did watch, you know, the quarterbacks of that era. But Starr was a heck of a quarterback. I mean, he really was. I mean, he was great. Great quarterback. And I wonder, you know, you cannot not include. All right, you have to include players in that era. I mean, we do it in baseball, right? Are we going to talk about the greatest baseball players of all time and not include Ted Williams? Right? We're not going to include, you know, Joe DiMaggio and Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb. And I mean, if you can't, like, have a cutoff point and just say, well, I'm going to make the cutoff point for the best of all time. Let's pick a year out in 1965. Well, that's not right. 1960. Well, believe it or not, folks, there were a lot of tremendous football players that played in the 50s. Now, I get the fact that the game's all different, and we understand that. But in their era, when they played, I mean, I watched Johnny Unitas play in person a number of times. Johnny Unitas was phenomenal. I mean, Johnny Unitas was like, I remember as a young boy going to watch Johnny Unitas play. It was like you knew at a very early age that you were watching like somebody that was like godlike. And I'm not kidding you. Like, that was special to watch Johnny Unitas play. That was like, that wasn't just like you were going to a football game. And I was blessed. I was at an NFL game every single Sunday beginning in the early 60s. I was at Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium every single Sunday. I watched all those quarterbacks play, and I watched them play every single Sunday. And I loved that era of football. I mean, loved it. I watched Fran Tarkenton play in person for many years with the Giants. I'm young enough to remember Bob Hayes playing with the Cowboys. You know, he was the fastest man in the world at that point. And, you know, you knew Bob Hayes. You would go, wow, Bob Hayes, look how fast he's running. I mean, I remember watching the Jets when they won the Super Bowl in the late 60s, and they had a right tackle, Sherman Plunkett. It was 320 pounds, and he was such a marvel, and everybody was talking about him because he was so big. You know, back then, your linemen were 100 pounds less than that. But he was like the first big offensive lineman, and people were like, how can he play? Now look at your offensive line. So that's why it's so difficult to compare errors. But Brett Favre, wherever you put him, he's a Hall of Famer. That part cannot be argued. We'll be right back. 339-1140 and 800-920-1140. We check in with Tom in Sacramento. Hello, Tom.
Hey, Grant. How are you?
I'm well.
As much as I hate the team, I haven't heard Roger Staubach's name come up. I think he belongs in the conversation.
I think he does, too. I don't know if I'd put him top five, but he's clearly in a top ten conversation. I don't think you can, you know, not include him, I guess, in the conversation.
I'm just a hair under 50, so when I started watching those battles between Bradshaw and Staubach, and I think people today in the past happy NFL forget how entertained we were by 14-12 games.
No question. Drew Pearson and Roger Staubach, one of the best passing combinations in the history of the National Football League. They had the great running back Calvin Hill. They had a tremendous defense back then. I mean, the Cowboys' defense was so good. They had, you know, Hall of Famers on both sides of the ball. You know, the Bob Lillies of the world. Roger Staubach was great.
Yeah, the battles between Mel Blunt and Drew Pearson.
Oh, that was back when football was a true man's game. I mean, that was back when, as a DB, you could mug the receiver all the way down the field.
I remember Pearson's broken ribs after the Super Bowl, just from Mel Blunt's elbows.
Yeah,
running down the field, and you know, not that you really want to see that.
No,
but at the same time, you know, I mean, it was a lot harder to do too. So,
hey, could you imagine Drew Pearson playing with the rules in the NFL now, where you can't touch him after 5 yards from the line of scrimmage? Can you imagine Drew Pearson? I mean, come on, you wouldn't be able to cover the guy.
Yeah, it would be fun, but you'd have 35 to 50 games, you know.
Yeah.
It's like somewhere along the line, you got to play defense. And,
I love watching Roger Staubach play. You know what I love about? He was always under control. He was a great scrambler. He was elusive, obviously very bright. I mean, you can't go through the Naval Academy and not be, like, you know, unbelievably bright. Just not a guy that made a lot of mistakes at the quarterback position. And
they were never out of it.
A Hall of Famer for sure, great quarterback.
and they were never out of it. You know, I mean, he earned the Captain Comeback moniker.
Yes, so, yes, he did. He did earn it. They were never out of it.
It's kind of one of those where if you got to pick one guy, you know, as you were saying earlier, for me, it comes down to Montana, Elway, and Staubach. And I think the best game I ever got to watch was that Monday Night Football game between Kansas City and Denver when it was Elway, Montana. That was a special game watching two absolute masters of their craft work.
Yeah, it's tough. Hey, listen, you have your favorite. I have my favorite. It's subjective in nature. The bottom line is it's great that we can talk about this. And, you know, it's great that you bring up a quarterback, you know, that played in a completely different era than what we're watching now. And, I mean, you bring the 70s in, and the Cowboys and the Steelers and, you know, the Dolphins in the early part of that century with Don Shula and the no-name defense. Bob Greasy and Paul Warfield may have been the best passing combination for a couple of years in the entire National Football League. And you know what? People don't talk about that enough. But you remember, Greasy and Paul Warfield were phenomenal. You couldn't stop the guys.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think Marino actually might have actually won a Super Bowl had John Offerdahl not had that wicked injury that took him out.
Could very well be.
His career. I mean, their run defense went from like 10 to 23rd when he got that ab injury that ended his career. So, I mean, you talk about one guy making a difference.
Hey, thanks very much for the call. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. Thanks.
I love talking about the NFL because I love talking about, you know, my memories that I had as a kid at both the Giants and the Jets games in the 60s and the 70s. And I can't even begin to tell you, like, how awesome it was to go to an NFL game every week. Like, I knew it was special back then. I knew that I was watching. And we never had good seats. I didn't care. We had the seats. Our seats at Yankee Stadium for the New York Giants games were in the bleachers. I didn't care. You know, I was one of 80,000 people at the old Yankee Stadium, and I was watching Jim Brown play one week, and you know, maybe Johnny Unitas, and you know, the great quarterbacks in that era, and tremendous running backs in that era, and I didn't care. You think I care? I never once ever thought about, gee, how come I don't have a better seat? In all my years of growing up, it never once entered my mind why I wasn't close to the playing surface, whether it was basketball, or you couldn't even go to the basketball. You couldn't even get tickets to the Knicks. Hockey, we always used to sit upstairs. I didn't care. I mean, that's why when people say, well, gee, you know, I can't go to a game and get good seats. Really? Like, do you think that you're going to take your son or daughter to a game and they're going to be complaining about their seats? No, they're not. They're not. It's not even going to enter their mind. All right? You go take your son and daughter to the Golden One Center for a Kings game, and you're sitting in the upper level, they're not going to be saying, hey, Dad, how come we're not sitting down below? That's not going to enter a kid's mind. They're so excited to be in the environment and the excitement of what is professional sports. I've never understood that, you know, where people call me, oh, I can't get good seats. Well, how important are good seats to you? I always wanted to be in the environment of a live sporting event. I didn't care where I was sitting. And again, as a kid, I probably was at more sporting events from birth until 18 than almost everyone listening right now. I would say I was probably at more sporting events than anyone listening right now. I really mean that. I mean, I'm talking about professional. We were always, I was at an NFL game every Sunday. I was at the hockey games during the winter. And with the New York Rangers, the matinee games that started in the I was so young when I went to hockey games. I used to think when they cleared the ice that there was a whole new game starting. I never cared about where. I never ever entered my mind. Never thought about it. I never thought about, gee, how great would it be to be sitting down there next to the field or the ice or the court. I can honestly tell you, consciously, it never ever entered my mind. Didn't matter. Did not matter. And I think for moms and dads that are listening, when you want to take your son or daughter to games, it you're taking them for the experience. Now, would the experience maybe be better if you were sitting on the court? Yeah, maybe it would. Okay? Maybe it wouldn't. I don't know the answer to that question. But I would just predict that your son or daughter going to a professional sporting event is not going to be griping about where they're sitting. That's my prediction. And the other thing is, there are, you know, and that's the one thing I love also about what they've done at the Golden One Center. All the seats are good again. It's just like it was at the old arena. You know, they designed that so it's for the fans. There are some arenas where I question the design, and part of that is because they have to house hockey as well. Just wait till you see the Golden One Center. Just wait till you see the sight lines. Just wait till you see how fan-friendly this place is. They did it right. They are doing it right. It's going to be phenomenal. October 4th, Paul McCartney. October 5th, Paul McCartney. Then the Kings a week later. And then before you know it, we're going to be talking about regular season basketball in an iconic state-of-the-art building. And I will tell you that if you, I mean, I can tell you right now, if you went home and told your son or daughter that you had tickets to opening night, but you know what, you're in the last row, they wouldn't say, gee, I don't want to go. All right, if you told them, hey, I got tickets, but we're in the upper deck behind the basket, I don't think your son or daughter would go, oh, man, really, I'm not going. Ah, no, I don't want to go. You go with somebody else. You know, sometimes we forget about the essence of sport and why sport exists. It exists because of the fans. And, you know, you don't turn on a TV and watch a baseball game and see no one at the game. You don't watch NFL on Sundays and you see an empty stadium. Sports exist because fans invest and they go to the games. Not everyone's sitting near the field. Not everyone's sitting near the court. Not everybody's sitting near the ice. Never quite understood that. Never quite understood that. I think we get spoiled. I'm very blessed, and I can say with all sincerity and honesty, I was never spoiled when it came to sports growing up. Now you say, what do you mean you never spoiled, Grant? You're right, games every Sunday. You know what? I was at games every Sunday, and my dad would give my brother and I $1.25 for our concessions for the whole game. And that's it. You know, and that could get you a hot dog, a popcorn, and a soda. And that's the honest truth. Sitting in the bleachers in the end zone at Yankee Stadium. Happiest kid in the world. Didn't care. All right. More to come. The Grant Napier Show, Sports 1140 KHDK.